We are in John chapter 12. That's where we left off. We're in the final week. Actually, we're within about the last 24 hours of Jesus' life before he was crucified. We'll back up a couple verses so that we are getting a run into this last bit. Look at verse 32. Jesus said, "And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me." And this he said, signifying what death he should die. "I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all." Men is in italics, which means it applies to you too, ladies. It's just everyone, as in all. If you look at the Greek, it's an interesting word. It means all. "If I be lifted up, I will draw all unto me." You know, we in the church can get weird trying to figure out, okay, how do we reach people? How do we get them in the door? How do we meet their needs? How do we appeal to the old folks? How do we appeal to the kids? How do we feel? How about we just lift him up and let him draw all men unto himself? The word lifted up there, it's got almost a dual meaning. On one side, it does mean to exalt, but it needs to be crucified. And he says in the next verse, he said that, signifying what death he should die. You know, God said through Paul in 1 Corinthians that he decided to use the foolishness of preaching to save those that are lost. And how the cross of Christ, it's foolishness to the Greeks, because they're into wisdom and knowledge, and it doesn't seem to make any sense. To the Jews, it's a stumbling block, because as we're going to see, they can't get over the fact that the Messiah was going to be crucified. It didn't seem to fit in with their theology. And yet that's the thing that draws all men unto Christ. And so our job, as we teach through the Scripture, is to make sure that we focus on Jesus Christ and him crucified on every page, on every section we go through, because it's on every page. That's the central story of the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament. Every Old Testament sacrifice, all of the rituals, the feasts, all of that speak of Christ and him crucified. And that needs to be something we focus on. When he said it, they didn't get it. In verse 34, the people answered him, "We've heard out of the law that Christ abides forever. And how sayest thou, the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" And again, there were, in the Old Testament, both sets of passages. You had the one with the ones that spoke of him as the conquering king. The government shall be upon his shoulders. You know, expecting the Messiah to come and set up his kingdom and every man to sit under his vine and his fig tree and to set Israel back up as the ruling nation. But yet there were also places like Psalm 22 that talked about him having his hands and his feet pierced. There was Isaiah 53 that spoke about him being the suffering servant. And they really couldn't reconcile that. And truthfully, they thought their biggest problem was being oppressed by Rome, that they were in bondage to Rome and they needed to be set free from Rome. And so that was the overriding principle. So that's what they were looking for God to do. However, God knew their need more than they did and knew that they were bound by sin more than Rome. Rome could only bind the physical body, not the spirit. And so he came to solve that problem. Interesting, they say, "We have heard," showing again that the religious leaders had focused on the things that they understood, and so that's what they taught. And they said, "You're saying that he must be crucified. Who is this Son of Man?" You know, what do you do with Jesus? What do we do with that? How do we deal with that? And I think as a world, we're still trying to figure out, how do you deal with that? You know, this holiday is an interesting one, because people don't have a problem celebrating Christmas, by and large. I mean, there are a few who are hardcore, you know, we can't talk about religion at all. But even to those who would normally be offended by Christ, Christmas is okay, because he's just a baby and he's in a manger and he doesn't say anything. And, you know, he's just cute in his mom and dad's arms. And we can remember, oh, holy night, silent night, so we don't have to hear anything we don't want to hear, you know. And yet, even from his very birth, you look at the manger scene. And yeah, I know the wise men didn't come till probably quite a bit later. But they're bringing gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And those, the gold speaking of his kingship, frankincense, speaking of, what does frankincense speak of? That's a good question. I forget what frankincense is. I'm going to have to look that up. Myrrh, though, myrrh is the embalming fluid, basically. Myrrh is, it's what they use to anoint the body for its burial. And it's like bringing, you know, formaldehyde to a christening. I mean, what I'm bringing, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Look, we got a lovely rest in peace wreath for your baby dedication. But yet, from his very birth, it spoke about his death. And so, who is this Son of Man? This is a great time of year to talk to people about why we celebrate Christmas, about why Jesus Christ had to come into this world, why he had to be born in the first place. When it comes to him crucified, people have to deal with it. They have to figure out what they're going to do. And he's going to make some more exclusive claims here. He says this in verse 35, "Then Jesus said unto them, Yet a little while is the light with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness come upon you. For he that walketh in darkness knoweth not whither he goeth. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may be the children of the light. These things spake Jesus, and departed, and did hide himself from them." Jesus says, you got the light just a little bit longer. They're asking him, who is the Son of Man? Why must he be crucified? And Jesus doesn't answer that. He doesn't come out and lay out the plan one more time. At this point, he's moving towards it. It's going to happen. And he just says, the light is with you for a little bit longer. Walk in the light so you're not in darkness. And then he hides himself. And then the very sad verse, we kind of left off with this last week, verse 37, "But though he had done so many miracles before them, yet they believed not on him." And that's because faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of God. Not faith comes by seeing miracles and eating bread from heaven. And they didn't understand. Notice, it was not a surprise. God was not bumming out that they didn't understand, that they didn't get him, that they didn't believe, because he predicted it. Look at verse 38. "That the saying of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spake, Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom hath the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore they could not believe, because Isaiah said again, He hath blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, that they should not see with their eyes, nor understand with their heart, and be converted, and I should heal them. These things said Isaiah when he saw his glory and spake of him." Now, here John quotes Isaiah. Well, first of all, notice this. Verse 38, that the saying of Isaiah. Verse 39, that Isaiah said again. Verse 41, these things said Isaiah. He says three times, John, that Isaiah wrote this stuff. That's interesting because he quotes from two sections of Isaiah. The first quote comes from Isaiah 53. You guys are familiar with Isaiah 53. It starts out this way, and it's in the context of Jesus saying, when they're asking, who is the Son of Man that he should be lifted up? We thought he abode forever. John quotes Isaiah 53:1, which says, "Who has believed our report, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, that when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed." John, talking about Isaiah 53, when Isaiah talked about the suffering servant Messiah, speaking of his crucifixion. Then he quotes the second bit, and that comes from Isaiah chapter 6, verse 10, when, you know, Isaiah saw the Lord high and lifted up. And one of the interesting things to note, if you do any studying, you probably will have heard of the Deutero-Isaiah theory. It's the literary critics have looked at Isaiah and they said, well, Isaiah probably wasn't written by anybody named Isaiah. It was actually written by at least a couple people, because the first part of Isaiah uses one set of language, but you get to the last part and we look and it's a whole different vocabulary, and so the words, they're different. So it was really probably written by a bunch of people. John didn't know anything about that because he said three times, no, Isaiah wrote the first part and Isaiah wrote the last part. And with all of that stuff, you know, they do the same thing with Daniel. People say, well, Daniel obviously was written well after the fact. There was really no Daniel. It was just somebody wrote it and pretended they were Daniel so we would believe the prophecies. But they were so detailed, they had to be written hundreds of years later. You look at the language and you can see he used words that weren't common at that time. Couldn't have been Daniel. Jesus said, it's Daniel the prophet that wrote it. So you have to find yourself in a position, gee, do the scholars who are looking at the text a couple few thousand years after it was written know more than Jesus? I don't feel comfortable following anybody who thinks they know more than Jesus. So here, John says, Isaiah, Isaiah, Isaiah. Isaiah wrote it. Look what he said. He said, therefore, well, it says in verse 37, they didn't believe on him, that Isaiah would be fulfilled. And then it says in verse 39 that they could not believe, because Isaiah said he blinded their eyes, he hardened their hearts. What you see is the logical progression. Because in verse 37, 38, they would not believe, God, and he did the same thing with Pharaoh when you look at the story in Exodus of Moses leading the people out of Egypt. Because Pharaoh would not believe, God hardened his heart and blinded his eyes so that he could not believe. Because, let's be honest, God can make anybody believe he wants to. You know, he's God. And just as easy as a puppeteer could jam a hand up his puppet's back and make his mouth move and say what he wanted, God could take us and say, I love you, Jesus. But it really wouldn't mean a whole lot if it was just him making us believe and us follow him. But there is a point. You know, you are responsible for whatever light you've been shown. Some of us, we live in America where there's the land of Christian radio and Christian television and Christian books in Walmart, and there's no excuse for anybody in America not knowing who Jesus Christ is. Certainly anybody who's come to church on a regular basis, at least here, knows and has heard. So you're responsible for that light. If you reject that, there is a point, you know, even back in Genesis, God says, my spirit will not strive with man forever. And there is a point where if you continually say, no, I know that's you, but I don't want to hear that right now, la, 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 it'll get to the point where you can't hear anymore. And so the Lord, confirming their choice, because they refused to hear, having seen amazing miracles, heard the words of Jesus, yet refused to believe that he was who he said he was because they didn't like what he came to do, it got to the place where they could not believe. Nevertheless, verse 42, among the chief rulers, also many believed on him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. Among the chief rulers, here is where you see Nicodemus. Nicodemus coming to him and at night, John chapter 3, said, we know that you're a man sent from God, saying he realized who Jesus, that Jesus was a godly man. Joseph of Arimathea would be another one. They knew that Jesus was who he said he was, but yet they were not willing to openly confess him because, and it told us that back in John chapter 9 with the blind man who was healed, his parents were afraid to talk about Jesus because they knew that anybody who said he was the Messiah would get excommunicated. And for them, that was a big deal. I mean, for us, let's be honest, if something happened here and we kicked you out of church, you got another dozen or so in town you could choose from, and you could go over there and most likely, if you know, we never got in touch with them, just continue on like nothing ever happened. Jewish culture, it was not that way. There was one temple, and if you were put out, you were excommunicated. Not only were you out of the temple in the only way to God, you were really ostracized from society. In a lot of places, your parents would not be allowed to have anything to do with you. They would treat you as if you were dead. They would, it's called sit shiva for you, and almost like have a funeral service for you because you were cast out. So it was a big deal. It cost a lot. For us, what does it cost to identify with Jesus? Okay, somebody might think you're weird, a Jesus freak or Bible thumper or whatever, but for many of them, it cost everything, and they did not want to be put out of the synagogue. So you've got guys in the inner circle, the religious leaders, Nicodemus, Joseph of Arimathea, who believe in him, but quietly. They're doing it in secret because they don't want anyone to know because of the repercussions. What I find interesting is when he is crucified, because at this point he hasn't been, and they don't understand, when he's crucified and he's put to death, and they are confronted face to face with the reality of the cross, and they understand the significance of the cross, they don't care anymore. At that point, it's Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, knowing what it's going to cost them, who go and take Jesus' body down, touching it, defiling themselves for the Passover holiday, openly embalming him, putting him in Joseph's tomb, not caring what anyone would think. You know, there's just no more hiding at that point. Once they come to the reality of the cross and they understand, there's no more faking it. There's no more being a silent Christian. I don't know about you, I remember when I was first saved, having that opinion that, well, I'm just going to try to live a good life. I'm not going to go out and just say anything to anybody. I'm just going to try to live a good life. and hopefully maybe somebody will see a difference in me. And then sometime, maybe in private, when nobody else is around, they'll ask me what's the difference, and then quietly I'll just tell them, well, it's Jesus, and I can lead them on. Well, that's not a bad thing. I think some of the most fruitful witnessing comes through relational witnessing. But I think there comes a point when you need to just be open about what you are. And that doesn't mean, you know, I need to put as many stickers on my car and T-shirts on and tattoos and, you know, you don't have to be weird. I mean, I have a sticker on one of my cars, and I have some Jesus T-shirts. There was a day when I wouldn't put them on because I was just ashamed. That's just too weird, too much, whatever. But I don't think, you know, a Jesus T-shirt on somebody who's hitting the bar doesn't mean a whole lot, does it? If anything, it brings reproach to his name. But it needs to be open and honest. It needs to be in your mouth. You need to be speaking the words of the Lord, and not with a bullhorn necessarily, but if you're speaking his word, it will have its effect. If you're being honest about who you are. And I think Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, when they were confronted with the cross, they said no more hiding. At that point, look what it says about verse 43. John doesn't cut them any slack at all. He says, for they love the praise of men more than the praise of God. And truthfully, it comes down to whose opinion matters more. Are you going to be upfront about who you are, or are you not? Because you can be a secret Christian for a while, but if you do that long enough, either the secrecy is what drowns out the Christian part, or the Christian part is going to drown out the secrecy part. They don't go together for too long. Pretty soon, you have to say something, because you're going to be put in more and more situations where it's an either or, and you got to be straightforward about who you are, or you just got to stifle it back. And it's horrible to be a man pleaser. It's something we all struggle with. And then verse 44, and this is the last public words that John records of Jesus in a teaching fashion anyways. It says, Jesus cried, he screamed it out and said, he that believeth on me believeth not on me, but on him that sent me. And he that seeth me seeth him that sent me. That's pretty interesting. He that believes on me believes not on me, but him that sent me. Okay, if I follow God, well, do you believe Jesus Christ? Oh, no, but I believe in God. Well, God sent Jesus Christ. Jesus, if you believe in him, you're believing in God. Conversely, if you don't believe in Jesus, then you don't believe in God. He said, he that seeth me seeth him that sent me. In chapter 14, he's going to be talking with the disciples. The next few chapters are going to be the private briefing before Jesus goes to heaven. He's trying to prepare his disciples for what they're going to face when he's gone. And he says, you know, I go to prepare a place for you, and you know the way. And Thomas says, know the way? I don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know where you're going. How can we know the way? And then Philip says, well, just show us the Father. That'll be good enough. And he's, Philip, show you the Father. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Don't you? How long have you been with me? You don't understand that? It tells us in Hebrews that he is the brightness of his glory, the express image of his person. That Jesus Christ is everything God the Father wants to show us about himself. And I like that, because there are so many people who look at the world around them and they say, I don't understand how God could be God and have this stuff happen. And yet, with all the stuff that happens, you look at Jesus Christ and you get an impression of who God is. There are those people who say, I don't want anything to do with God because everybody who's a believer is a bunch of hypocrites. And they play a game, and on the outside, they look all holy, and in the inside, they're just like everybody else. Well, Jesus had something to say about people like that. It was pretty much, woe, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. You may clean the outside of the cup, but inside you're filthy. You know, you're full of dead men's bones. You're like a whitewashed tomb. That's what God thinks about somebody who just plays the game. I'm sick of Christians. I don't want to hear anything about church because they're all just out to rip you off. Everybody, they're just after your money. They're begging for it on TV. They're putting thermometers outside the building. That's what they want. Well, Jesus had something to say about that as he was kicking over tables and laying a whip across people's back. And he said, you've turned my Father's house, supposed to be a house of prayer, into a den of thieves. There are those people who say, well, I don't want anything to do with religion because it's all about condemning. They're just telling me, you're bad, you're awful, you're going to hell, I condemn you, I don't want to hear that anymore. Well, what did Jesus say when they brought the woman caught in the act of adultery? He said, neither do I condemn you. Well, I don't want to believe in God because there's a bunch of Christians and they don't do anything about sin. Everybody's just living the way that they want. Well, Jesus said something about that. He said, go and sin no more. I mean, he says everything that you want to know about what God thinks about a situation, Jesus has to say something about it. Well, what does it matter? This is all, you know, everybody has a different religion, and it doesn't matter whether I'm a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Muslim. I can be whatever I want. I can still get to God. Well, what did Jesus say? Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, the life. No one's come to the Father but by me. He speaks on every issue of what God's opinion is on a matter. Anybody who sees him sees the one that sent him. He says, I am come a light into the world, that whosoever believeth on me should not abide in darkness. And if any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. How about you? How about me? What did we come for? Did we come to judge the world, or do we come to save the world? He is coming back to judge the world. That's going to happen. But in this particular instance, that's not why he's here. He's here to save. Seek and save that which was lost. You know, when we come into a situation, are we coming into a situation to judge, or are we coming into a situation to save? Are we the paramedic, or are we the cop? Do we look to bind up the wounded or assign guilt to the guilty? Jesus, when he came the first time, was here not to judge, but to save the world. He that rejects me and receives not my words, hath one that judges him. The word that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. And that's the truth, you know. Whatever word, whatever light somebody has been exposed to is going to be what they're going to be judged by. And those who have heard the truth in the last day are going to remember hearing that truth and for all eternity know, I could have, I should have, but I didn't. He says, for I have not spoken of myself, but the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting. Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father said unto me, so I speak. Jesus, obedient to the end, his words were not his own, lived a perfect life, doing perfectly the will of the one who sent him. Now we come to John chapter 13, and we come to Jesus dealing with his disciples. Look what it says in verse 1. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. Before the feast of Passover. Jesus knew that his hour was come. You know, we go to Christmas. I ended up driving out to my sister's last night. And, you know, it was 6:30, so it was dark out and everybody's Christmas stuff was lit up. And I always... cracks me up to go by manger scenes. It's nice to see how people arrange manger scenes. You know you're in Maine when the back of the manger is a blue tarp held down with duct tape. you see Jesus as a baby. And I think it's really interesting that we have very few pictures of Jesus' life before his baptism. We have the manger scene when he's born. We have him going to the temple to be circumcised. We have just the, you know, one or two sentence account of his parents fleeing when Herod was killing all the babies and taking him to Egypt. Then we have the story when he was 12 and he's in the temple and he's teaching. And then we don't hear anything else until he shows up on the scene. And there's a couple things out of that. It tells us in chapter 2, verse 40 of Luke, that the child grew, speaking of Jesus, and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. Then in verse 52 of Luke chapter 2, when he's at the temple and he's disputing or talking with the religious leaders, and then his parents who lost him, you know, imagine being the parents that lost the Messiah. Ah, I thought you had him, you know, and 3 days later they got to go back and we lost the Messiah. And then they find him and where were you? Don't you know your father and I were worried? Speaking of Joseph, and Jesus kindly lets her know that he's not my father. Don't you know I should be about my father's business? But then it says he went back and was subject to them, which is amazing in and of itself, that God would be subject to earthly parents. And it says there that Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. And you think about, I mean, the amazing thing about Christmas is that the creator of the universe would humble himself to the point of becoming a baby. Think about God going, I mean, but he must have, right? He was a baby. He had to be fed. He went and he blew food all over the place. The creator of the universe, all-powerful, all-knowing, wearing a ditty. being rocked to sleep. You know, there are fantastic tales about him doing miracles as a child. John tells us the miracle at the wedding in Cana was his first of miracles. So he just was an ordinary kid. Remember what we read earlier in Isaiah, how there was nothing about him that we should desire him. He didn't float a foot off the ground. He didn't have a glowing head. He didn't, the angels didn't sing whenever he opened his mouth. He was just a kid who scunned his knee and who, I mean, he didn't sin, so he didn't mouth off to his parents. I'm sure his brothers hated him because he's half-brothers, because he never does anything wrong. Yes, you're right, he doesn't. But he knows everything. Can't get away with anything. Well, that's true. But the fact that Jesus would allow himself to grow, would allow himself to have to learn how to walk, to learn how to talk, that he would allow himself to be subject to his parents. And you wonder, I always wonder, when did he know what did he know and when did he know it? At some point he knew. Now, I would say personally, definitely by the time he was baptized, he knew what the whole scheme was. He knew the whole scheme. But when did he know? He knew when he was 12 that he must be about his father's business. So it seems like he knew at 12 and he was full of the Holy Spirit and all that, who he was and that there was something different. But when? I don't know. We don't get a real clear answer that this was the day when, boom, the light went on. Certainly, it seems, he had a level of communication with the Father that we don't understand. Because he's continually, you know, the voice will go from heaven. It did last week, and he said, that wasn't for me, that was for you. I don't need the voice, because I talk to him all the time. I only say what he tells me to say. But now, it says, Jesus knew that his hour was come. He said over and over again, my hour is not yet come. They'd go to lay hands on him. They'd pick up rocks to kill him. Then he'd just walk out to the middle of them because my hour was not yet come. Well, now the hour is here. And within 24 hours, he's going to be hanging on a cross. It was the hour when he should depart out of this world and unto the Father. He knew what he was there for. He knew where he was going. And he says he loved his own which were in the world. And he loved them unto the end. And it doesn't just mean, you know, till he died. It means unto the fullness, to the fullest extent he loved them. Romans tells us how much, Romans 5:8, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. That's how much God commends his love for us. I like that it says that he loved them unto the end, because it reminds me of Philippians 1:6, being confident of this very thing, that he which has begun a good work in you will perform it unto the day of Jesus Christ, that he will complete his plan to the end. But it's interesting to see what he does, because we're at the Last Supper, okay? And think about this, especially those of you who are maybe from a Catholic background. This is John. This is John. He's the last living apostle at this point. He's 90 years old. He's remembering back to the Last Supper. You guys are familiar with Da Vinci's painting of the long table, and sitting in the chairs, and they're all splayed out. That's erroneous. It isn't like that at all. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the Last Supper, you'd think, well, what was the most important thing that happened at the Last Supper? If you're Catholic, you'd say the Eucharist, of course. That's it. That's when he said his body became, you know, became the bread and the wine became his blood. And that John doesn't even mention that. He just goes right to this. To John, this was the most important thing of all that stood out to him. And beyond everything else that happened, this is the thing he wants to convey, to let you know. Remember, he said the purpose of this gospel was to let you know that Jesus was the Son of God. Look what it says. It says, the supper being ended, the devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. When you read the other gospel accounts, before the Last Supper, Judas went and made his deal with the priests to betray Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. It happened before the Last Supper. So now he's looking for an opportunity to do it, right? That's why when they got ready to have the Last Supper, where are we going to have this thing? Jesus doesn't say to the disciples, yeah, it's going to be at 165th Donkey Street. You know, he doesn't say that at all. He doesn't give an address. What he does is he tells Peter and John, look, I want you to go into town, and when you walk into town, you're going to see a guy carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him. When you get to that house, go in, talk to the owner of the house, say the master needs a place, and there'll be a room prepared. He gives this really kind of cryptic way of saying where it's going to be, because he doesn't want Judas to know, because he knows Judas is going to betray him. So he doesn't give Judas opportunity. It's not until later, when he goes to the place where he frequented, the garden, when Judas would know that he would go there, that's where he's betrayed. But this place he keeps secret. He gives his covert little message about how to get there. But Judas has already purposed in his heart, Satan has already laid it on his heart to betray Jesus. He's made his deal with the religious leaders. He's still at the supper. It kind of blows me away that when communion was instituted, or the Eucharist, if that's what you want to call it, Judas was there for the first one. Do you think it conveyed any grace upon Judas to drink that cup and to eat that bread? I don't think so. And then we're going to get to the foot washing part. Judas is there for that as well, which blows me away that Jesus, knowing Judas was going to betray him, keeps him there through all of this. It says the supper is ended. They've at least gone through the communion portion. It says Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and that he was come from God, and that he went to God, he rises from supper, laid aside his garments, and took a towel and girded himself. Supper. The supper that they would eat, they would sit at a table. It's called a triclinium, and it looks sort of like a U or a horseshoe, you know. And people would lay all along the outside. They'd have cushions all along the outside, and they would all sort of recline on their left hand. Remember, in the Eastern culture, hands had an assigned purpose. Right hand was for eating, it was for fellowship. Left hand was for doing business that was best left to a hand that didn't meet other people. And so they would lay on their left and eat with their right. If you were a left-handed person, you were kind of in tough shape. And they would kind of recline. You know how it is when you go to a meal? A meal would last a long time, multiple course, and they would eat over a long period of time. You know how it is when you eat and eat and eat, like a Thanksgiving meal, Christmas dinner, you get to the point where you're kind of stuffed and then overstuffed, and you're either opening the belt buckle or you're wishing you'd worn sweatpants because you want to really breathe deep and you got some restrictions going on. You know, you're looking for the maternity pants at that point with it look like jeans, but underneath the shirt, you know, there's a stretch band so you can expand. Well, they wouldn't mess with that. They would just wear a robe and lay right out to start with. So they'd be in the position where they could really consume a lot of food. And the servants would be able to come in the inside of the table and fill the plates and everything, and they would lay along the outside and they'd break off the bread and they'd dip it in the bowl and double dip, and it was an intimate thing. There was an order to how you sat at any feast. There was order of importance. The second seat would be the host. When you started at the right and went around the table, the second seat would be the host, which would be Jesus. He would have been in the second seat. The first seat would be the best loved of the host, which is where John sat, because remember, he's the one who said that he could put his head back and lay it on Jesus' breast. So John would have been in the first seat. Then there would have been Jesus. The third seat was the guest of honor, which is where Judas was, because Jesus said the one who dips and he gave the sop to, the only people he could give the sop to, dip in the sauce and give it, would have been John on one side or Judas on the other. So he had Judas, the one who was going to betray him, right there in the place of honor. And then they went around the table from the highest to the lowest point of importance. We know from another gospel that Peter, because Jesus had said earlier, when you go to a feast, don't take the high seat. You want to take the low seat. Because if you take the high seat and then somebody more important than you shows up, the host is going to take you, and in front of everybody, he's going to humiliate you and send you down to the low spot. What you want to do is you want to shoot for the low spot. And then when the host comes in, he's going to see you down there and he's going to say, oh, friend, what are you doing down there? And then in front of everybody, he's going to show honor to you and he's going to bring you up. Peter heard that one. So Peter doesn't know a whole lot. When you don't know what to do, fall back on what you do know. I remember he said, go for the low seat. So Peter goes for the low seat. And we know he's there because later on in another gospel, when Jesus says somebody's going to betray him, Peter, it says, yells across to John and says, who's he talking about? Ask him who he's talking about. So the only way he could do that is if he was all the way on the other end of the horseshoe. So Peter, and we're going to see here too, when Jesus goes around and washes, he comes to Peter at the end. Peter took the low seat. But we're going to also see that he took the low seat not because he thought he was low, but because he was trying to make a point about being brought up. He just was, aren't you going to come get me and bring me to the front? It apparently didn't happen. But so anyways, they're around that. They've eaten. Now, what's going to happen is the foot washing. It says the low job in the house was washing feet. You would have house slaves, especially the more important or wealthy you were, you would have servants in the house, and there would be some that would be slaves. The low job on the totem pole was washing feet. Okay, they lived in the Middle East. They wore sandals. Animals were in the streets. You know, it was nasty, okay? You walk in dust. You know what it's like in the summertime if you're a sandal person or a barefoot person? My kids barefoot all summer, and they, you send them out in shoes, and then they come back without shoes, and they walk around, and then somebody spills some water, and they walk through the water, and then you see these black footprints. The kids' feet, it doesn't matter how much you bathe them, their feet are always black. Well, in this culture, imagine walking like that all the time, in the dust, in the dirt, through the where the animals have been. Nasty feet. Nasty, nasty. So you'd come into the house, and the thing that the low servant would do would be to wash the feet. Get a bowl, which is weird to think about, but that's what they would do. Clean your feet up before, so you could come in and you wouldn't be, you know, getting on the cushion and putting dirty feet on the cushion or on the couch. You know, you want to be clean. Well, the deal is, supper's ended and nobody's washed feet. There's no servants there. It's Jesus and the disciples. There's no slaves. And these guys, although Peter has made a show of taking the low seat, he didn't make a show of grabbing a bowl and washing anybody's feet because he didn't think he deserved to be in the low seat. He went to the low seat because he figured if I go to the low seat, he's going to bring me a pie because after all, I know I'm the top dog. I'm at least in the top three. I was on the Mount of Transfiguration, me, James, and John. And they went and asked their mommy to have the seat at the right hand and the left. And Jesus said no. So who else is going to be there? Obviously me. And let me prove that by taking the low seat. I'm not going to wash anybody's feet. I mean, let's not be ridiculous. But I will take the low seat. And so everybody's sitting there at the table, communion's ended, and they still got dirty feet. Now, they've partaken of his body and blood at this point, even though it hadn't turned to body and blood yet. It was a symbol of what was to come. But their feet are still all dirty. Nobody's done it. In fact, when you read Luke chapter 22, it's at this point in the story when they're arguing about who's going to be the greatest. Because obviously Peter is saying, okay, yeah, I know I'm down here, but he obviously is overlooking, okay? I should have been in the front. I don't know why John's there because he wanted, you know, he asked his mommy to tell him to be. And they're fighting, they're arguing, and it's in the middle of that, Jesus, and those of you who went through the call to serve and saw that Gail Irwin teaching, I love that, you know, when he's talking about all of the power, all of the might, and he stands up and he goes to those losers who are arguing. No, we'll get back to that, you know. But truthfully, here's Jesus, and it says he knows that all things have been given into his hand, all power, all authority, all might, everything. And he's surrounded by a bunch of idiots who for 3 years have been arguing and fighting about who would be the greatest, and they still don't get the fact that he's going to be crucified within 24 hours. They don't get the fact that he's going to go through the worst beating of his life. He's got all power, all authority. Here they are. Nobody even washed anybody's feet. And what does he do? It said he rises from supper. He laid aside his garments, took a towel, girded himself. After that, he poureth water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel wherewith he was girded. And when you think about this, this in a lot of ways is a type of what happened on a spiritual side, because it says, after the dinner, he rises from supper. What is supper? We talked about this. In Jewish culture, eating with somebody is the highest, one of the highest forms of intimacy, because when you and somebody else are dipping out of the same bowl, you're real familiar. You're saliva familiar at that point. You know, you're eating, they're dipping and everything. So supper is a picture of intimate communion with somebody. That's why the religious leaders freaked whenever Jesus ate with prostitutes and tax collectors, because they were sinners and you don't eat with them. They might get, you know, sin cooties all over you. And yet, Jesus was in intimate communion with the Father. You know, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. The same in the beginning was in the beginning with God. There's that intimate fellowship going on, and yet, Jesus rose up from that. Here it said, he laid aside his garments. Well, there he was, clothed in light. He was with God, and he was God. And yet, he laid aside portions of his divinity in order to humble himself. Here it says he put on a towel. The word towel there in the Greek, it speaks of linen. Like, you know, and of course, we're told that linen, fine and white, it has to deal with righteousness and everything. But here's Jesus laying aside parts of his deity to put on flesh and to gird himself with a towel, with the lowest thing. And then he pours water into a basin. And what's he getting ready to do? He's getting ready to pour out his blood. He's getting ready to pour out his life. And he begins to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel wherewith he was girded. And more than just washing their feet, you know, washing them with his blood. Remember what Ephesians 5 tells us, husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. And he starts cleaning their feet. What is the atmosphere around the table at this point? When they see Jesus taking on the role of the lowest slave, is there any of them that's saying, I can't believe he's doing that? I should be doing that? I don't think there is. In fact, I think it's going on. I think they're dumbstruck, because this is not something that anybody would do unless they were made to do it, because washing feet is just weird. It's bad enough washing your own feet. Washing somebody else's feet is just weird, you know? And yet Jesus is cleaning them, hands on. Now, Peter's watching this from the end, and he's last one in line, and you know what he's thinking, because in the same way that he was thinking, I should have been in the front, and I took the low seat like he said, I can't believe he didn't come get me, but that, it's just a test. I know it's a test, and I know what to do in this situation. I know what's going to happen. I know, look at these guys, they're letting him do it, they're blowing it, but man, I got the right answer when he comes to me. And it says, then cometh he to Simon Peter, and Peter saith unto him, Lord, dost thou wash my feet? I know this one. Jesus answered and said unto him, what I do thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter. Now when Jesus tells Peter, you don't understand, it should be a clue to Peter. When you don't understand, just keep your mouth shut. But it isn't. He doesn't get that yet. He will understand. He's going to talk in 1 Peter 5 about clothing yourself in humility. I think he finally gets it later on. But here he doesn't. And it says in verse 8, Peter saith unto him, thou shalt never wash my feet. You shall never wash my feet. Right answer, right? Absolute wrong answer. Jesus said, answered him, if I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. Now, the good thing about Peter is he is a 100% guy. And when he's 100% wrong, he'll do a 180 and take the other position immediately. And Simon Peter saith unto him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Look, all or nothing. Okay, if you got to wash me, then don't just stop at my feet. You might as well do the whole thing. Dump the bowl over my head, you know, wash me all away. And Jesus saith unto him, he that is washed needeth not save to wash his feet, but is clean every whit. And you are clean, but not all. He said, you know, now, Pete, you're already clean. Of course, he had already done the whole communion thing with them, but their feet were dirty. When you went, and this carried over to public baths in those days. Have you ever, when I was first married, my wife and I used to go to Creation Music Festival every year out in Pennsylvania. And middle of these farms, these fields, nothing there. And then overnight, 50,000 people would show up, camp out for, you know, most better part of a week, watching concerts. And they would set up outdoor showers, you know, where it's just like PVC tubing and tarps, or they would build some rough structures or whatever, and you'd go and you'd take this cold shower. And you'd get as clean as you could. Now, you're out all day in the field, in the dirt, in the dust, and then you get in there and you scrub yourself as clean as you can. But then to get back to your camping area, which maybe would be a quarter of a mile, half a mile away from where the showers were, you'd throw on your flip-flops, and by the time you get back there, you'd be just mucked from, because your feet are wet, and then you get out there and you walk through the dirt, and so from at least your ankles down, you're just all foul again. So then it's time to get dressed, because you don't get dressed in the public shower. You just get in there, you do your business, try not to touch the walls or anything, and then you get out. So you get back to your tent, and it's like, oh, I got to clean my feet again. So you got to have a jug of water with you that you can pour over your feet, because once you're clean, you don't have to do the whole body. It's just the part that touches the surface that really has to be dealt with. Well, Jesus is saying, look, you're already clean. I've made you clean, but your feet, your walk, the feet just need to be touched up, because as you walk, stuff clings to you. And truthfully, for you and I, we walk in this world. We live in this world. We have to read the books and see the television and hear the radio that's in this world, and stuff clings to you. You ever notice that? It just seems like it clings to you. And we have those two cats at my house. And they're short-haired cats. I've kind of made a commitment that I'm never going to do a long-haired cat again, but I do have some short-haired cats. And it doesn't matter what you do, how many times you wash your clothes, what you do with them, just in the process of putting on something and walking to the door, it's like a magnet. There's a static, especially this time of year where there's no moisture in the air, and it's like the hairs just come boom, right to everything you have, and they just cling, and you've got to get the tape out or get one of those sticky things. Well, this world is like that, and it clings to us, and it grabs. And Jesus said, you're already clean. You just need to have your feet cleansed. He says, but it's clean every whit. And you are clean, but not all. For he knew who should betray him. Therefore said he, you are not all clean. But yet he washed Judas's feet. And nobody else knew but Jesus and Judas. When Jesus is going to say one, he's going to betray me, everybody's going to say, is it me? Is it me? Nobody's going to say, it's Judas, isn't it? I can tell. Look at him. He just looks shifty. You just tell by his eyes. Nobody says that. He says, is it me? Is it me? Jesus washed his feet. And after he had washed their feet and had taken his garments and was set down again, and again, in the same way that Jesus put off a portion of his divinity to put on flesh and live among us, after he had completed what he had come here to do and washed us with his blood and through his life, he was risen again. What does it tell us in Hebrews chapter 10? That he sat down at the right hand of God. Beautiful picture of what he did here. He was set down again, and he said unto them, know you what I have done to you? You call me Master and Lord, and you say well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done unto you. Now you read that, the question that comes to my mind is, well, does that mean that we should be doing foot washings? Anybody ever been to a church that does foot washings before? Or some that do what they call three-part communion, and they'll do, you know, the bread, the wine, and then they'll break up, and guys get with guys, and ladies get with ladies, and you wash each other's feet. I don't go to churches like that. I'm sorry. It's weird if you... There's a reason why we don't biblically. I mean, first of all, when you do that, let's be honest. If you knew that was happening, right? If you knew we were going to do that, and you were like, well, that's my church, and so we're going to go there. What would you do before you came to church? You'd scrub those toes, okay? You'd get out the thing and you'd dig the black stuff out of the corners. You'd pick the pieces of the sock that's tucked down in the nail bed. You'd get the jam would be gone, and it'd be clean socks, and you'd find the shoes that don't smell like your feet all the time, and you'd wear those. You'd want to present the cleanest feet you could for somebody else to wash, because you don't want them to get nasty with your old feet. But that defeats the purpose. These guys had nasty feet, and Jesus did it anyways. It's not about cleaning yourself up so people would think, I'm going to do this ritual, but they don't really need it because they've got powdered feet anyways. No, it's about doing more than that. But as far as church practice goes, you know, what do you do? What do we practice as a church? We see foot washing here, and Jesus talks about foot washing, but a good rule of thumb is if it's done in the Gospels, if you then see it practiced in the book of Acts, and then you see it taught on or expounded upon in the epistles, it's a pretty good safe thing that it's something you're supposed to do. You look at baptism. Baptism was done in the Gospels. Book of Acts, they were baptizing. In the epistles, there is expounding upon baptism. Communion is the same way. We see it practiced in the Gospels. We see in the book of Acts that they had all things, you know, in Acts chapter 2, they... continued in the breaking of bread. We get into Corinthians 11, and Paul talks about how the Lord's Supper should be handled. So those things, but foot washing, we don't see that. We see a reference or two where it talks to people about washing the saints' feet, but it's really talked about as serving. And I think what Jesus is making for a point here is you have seen how, as the greatest among you, I have humbled myself and I've washed your feet. How much more should you also ought to wash one another's feet? For I've given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. And you notice what Jesus didn't do was he didn't go around the table and say, John, you have dirty feet. You need to do something about it. Pete, look at that funk. You need to clean those things up, man. Judas. He didn't do that. He didn't go around pointing out dirty feet. He just quietly went around cleaning feet. And these are his disciples. These are people that he loved. And what he does is he cleans feet. He gets his hands dirty. He gets involved in other people's dirt, and he helps clean them. He doesn't make them feel bad about their dirt. He doesn't make a big deal about pointing out the dirt. In fact, he makes sure he goes to everybody so everybody knows they have dirt. But he just cleans their feet. A couple more verses. Look at this. I have given you an example in verse 15 that you should do as I have done to you. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, neither is he that is sent greater than he that sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. if you know these things, he doesn't say happier you if you know them. He doesn't say happier you if you study them. Happier you if you memorize the verses all about them. Happier you if you can quote them. He says happier you if you do them. I am convinced that the Lord is all about people. People are really frustrating sometimes. Believers are really frustrating sometimes. The church is made up of people. That's why sometimes the church will fail you. Well, it's people in the church. Jesus doesn't fail. It's made up of people who get dirty and who make mistakes and who step in stuff they shouldn't. And yet Jesus didn't separate himself from them. Even this is 24 hours before he's going to go through the most horrible abuse anybody's ever gone through. And yet here he is in the midst of a bunch of people who are fighting and complaining about who is the greatest, washing their feet, getting his hands dirty, and saying, you don't understand what I'm doing now, but you will understand, and you'll be happy if you do these things. You know, after he goes, he sends the Holy Spirit to be our comforter, to be in us, to come upon us, to empower us for service. We're told in Corinthians that he, through the Holy Spirit, gives gifts to the church, severally, as he will. And he goes through those spiritual gifts, prophecy, tongues, word of wisdom, word of knowledge. There's other ones in Romans where he talks about, you know, administration or ruling, organization, those people who have the gift of helps, people who have the gift of mercy, people who have the gift of faith. And the Lord gives all those things because he looks at the church and he says, that church is horribly incomplete. They don't have what they need, so I got to give somebody, look at how disorganized they are. We better give somebody supernaturally the gift to be able to actually administer things in the church. Look at that. Those people that I've got together in that body, by default, they're a bunch of hard redneck Mainers. I better give somebody supernaturally the gift of mercy and the gift of love to be able to go in and minister to them. And yet in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, it tells us that he gives those gifts to profit with all. The purpose of those gifts that he gives is not for you. He doesn't give you a word of wisdom because he wants you to be really smart. He gives you the word of wisdom because you're in with a collection of idiots who need somebody with some wisdom, and you don't have any either, so he gives it to you so that you can share it. He talks about spirituality, Paul does, in Galatians chapter 6. He says this, brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, and certainly having dirty feet is typical of being overtaken in a fault, stepping in something you shouldn't step in, getting the world's dirt on you. If a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. You know, for us to go about washing feet, one of the things that we should become conspicuously obvious to us is the fact that we have dirty feet to start with. And yet according to Paul, a spiritual person is one who is about restoration. They're not about separation, they're not about isolation, they're about restoration. And the purpose of being spiritual is to restore, is to seek and save that which is lost, to find a brother, being careful, you know, taking care of the beam in your own eye before you go picking specks out of somebody else. But truthfully, as believers, we're supposed to be intimately involved in each other's lives. We're supposed to ask each other the hard questions. Hey, what have you been reading lately? Hey, how you been treating your wife? Hey, how are your kids doing? You been yelling at them? You know, I saw you in the parking lot, you know, before you put the smile on, when you were still talking like you did back at the house. Then you get in and, praise the Lord, brother. Good to see you. Isn't God good? Yeah, he wasn't coming out of your car. You were yelling at the back seat. I can see it swinging all the way in. You know, get sit down. We're almost there. Be happy. We're Christians. You know. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. I know all you guys. I think you're all believers. I think 60 years later, 75 years later, must have been. John was a young guy, so he's 90 at this point. He looks back. More than anything else, by this whole night, he's blown away with the fact that Jesus got his hands dirty with his disciples. Even when they didn't deserve it, when they were still filthy, he got his hands dirty with them. My challenge to you is let's be men and women who get our hands dirty in each other's lives. This is not a social club. This is not, you know, Lincoln Elks Club. It's Lincoln Christian Fellowship. Fellowship means two fellows in the same ship. You've heard me say before, very intimate, two people in a canoe. You share food, you share bait. Any body functions that go on in a canoe, both people are aware of what happened. I mean, that's how we're supposed to be. So let's be like Jesus and wash feet. Amen? Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much that you would lay aside, Lord, your place in glory so that we would have a place at your table. I don't know why you would want to invite us to sup with you, but you have. We know you're patient, you're long-suffering, you're not willing that any should perish. Lord, help us to have your heart. Lord, help us not to come to condemn, but to come to seek and to save. Help us to be willing. Lord, give us your spirit because you know sometimes the spirit's willing and the flesh is weak. It's no fun getting dirty with other people's feet. But Lord, make us men and women who see with your eyes, hear with your ears, have your compassion, your heart, and use us however you can. Pray, Lord, that you would bless my brothers and sisters. You'd give them safe travel home. And fill us with your spirit, and that you'd come quickly. We ask it in the name of Christ our King. Amen.